when you're working with GDP or unemployment data, we're used, and this isn't just data journalists, but any journalist, you're used to seeing a number and you just know that that number is what it is. But the thing that's become very apparent early on here is that that's absolutely not the case. And so most of our work as data journalists is getting to the point when we can compare these numbers to one another. And that includes a lot of adjustments and checking against alternative data sources all the way through.
Welcome back, everybody, to Media Voices. We're the media-focused podcast that brings you the news and views from the media world. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
And that extract you just heard was from our interview with John Byrne Murdoch, whose work most of you will almost certainly have seen on the Financial Times' coronavirus trajectory charts. He talked about the challenges of working with data this complicated, how the FT's approach to the trajectory charts has actually evolved as the crisis has continued, and why data journalists are the new rock stars in journalism.
Well, I think podcasters are the new rock stars of journalism.
Yeah,
Esther, but
I'm not sure.
It's a great interview, and for those of you who want to skip straight to it, we've put that timestamp in the show notes.
Not that you'd want to skip us lot, right?
Well,
absolutely not.
Why would anyone want to skip us? What the hell?
Well, for those of you sticking around, we're going to begin with our news roundup. And this time the theme is ad decline and what publishers are doing to stay stable. So many global brands are freezing ad spend for at least 6 months amid this COVID-19 crunch. So 89% of large multinational companies have deferred marketing campaigns this month, up from 81% in March. Holy shit, I was reading that out and then I saw the figure again.
I think it's that 52% of marketers that have said that they're holding back ad spend for at least 6 months. Like that's half of all the world's biggest global brands that have said they're not spending for the next half a year. That's insane.
Yeah, and I effectively saw a really good argument made this week, actually, that a lot of publishers are loath to get into any branded content deals as well, just because they don't know if the companies that will pay for that will be around to pay for them 6 months down the line.
There's just so many stories around this, you know, a lot of stuff around payment terms extending and being horrendous, people having to accept ridiculous payment terms. If we don't switch this episode to what people are doing to stay stable, this is going to be a really depressing episode of the Media Voices podcast, because it's just awful. Low point for me on this one is this week is the DigiDay podcast with Randall Rothenberg, who's CEO of the IAB, the Internet Advertising Bureau. And he pretty much said, publishers, you've got to diversify your revenue streams, period, full stop. Now, that's the guy that runs the Internet Advertising Bureau. But the one bright spot I also saw, I think it was also DigiDay, is that direct-to-consumer ads are doing better. So yeah, where the branding ads, people that are focused on people who are advertising delivery services and direct-to-consumer stuff are actually spending more money, as they would. I mean, so that's something, I suppose.
It is. And I suppose that actually leads on to the next item here, which is that Hearst have reported significant e-commerce upturns during the COVID-19 lockdown. So, Esther, what's been the cause of that?
I get the good news story this week.
You do?
Yeah, really?
Yeah, this is really good. I will just frame this with Amazon cutting its affiliate rates wasn't great for publishers who diversified into affiliate revenue. But Hearst have actually reported a lot of their titles, like Good Housekeeping, has seen an increase of 567% on the previous year.
Big number.
Men's Health, 546%. And even Cosmopolitan has had a 388% increase in e-commerce. And they said that they started to notice, unsurprisingly, it was about the second week of March, that when the non-essential businesses closed, and this is in the US, everybody suddenly kind of flocked to online. So those articles about, you know, top 10 hand sanitizers or top 10 face masks shot up. And what was quite interesting is that FIP have got this statement from Emily Silverman, who's their senior e-commerce director at Hearst. And she says that what the people do there is that they keep an eye constantly on how people are getting to their articles and what they're particularly interested in, which makes sense. I mean, you know, if you get a period of hot weather, you like to have a spike in searches for air conditioning, and that's fairly common in the affiliate scene. And they've said actually in this case, they responded really quickly to that feedback loop, because as they saw the increases, they were able to kind of serve readers what they were looking for and, yeah, sort of tailor what they were writing towards that. So that's,
what,
that's really good.
Hand sanitizers.
But yeah, I mean, they've seen growth across things like everything from like home, health, beauty, self-care, wellness, all that sort of thing.
We've seen a lot of evidence that particularly DIY stuff is doing really well in terms of e-commerce. So anywhere that's like, here's top 10 home improvements things you can do, has this huge, great opportunity at the moment.
Yeah, so Future in the UK released stats a while. It was mid-March when they first started to see the swing that all of their home titles, it was the home improvement, they'd suddenly got all this stuff, this huge upswing for DIY and you know, ladders and all that sort of thing on their home brands, which was really fascinating.
To what extent, then, do we think this actually just validate what publishers have been saying for years, that their audiences trust them and their recommendations over, say, Amazon's? Because Amazon does have that huge amount of data, and particularly around your consumer journey to purchase.
You can't navigate Amazon.
That's not true.
Yeah, Amazon's really, really good at sourcing you the stuff you need. Yeah. Even though
it
will show. Yeah, I find it really, really useful for book recommendations. Anyway.
I think, you know, and one of the things that would be really interesting to see is the increase in Amazon sales and the increase in publisher sales, because I bet, yeah, they're almost exactly the same. This isn't being driven by publishers. Hearst, clearly, from what Esther's saying, has done an amazing job to take advantage of it. But it's just the fact that online shopping is the only way to go at the moment. That's what's driving this.
So right place, right time for them.
Right place, right time. But now, I think that's where maybe Hearst will do better than someone else, because they are trusted.
I suppose probably where these publishers will do better, I mean, I'm thinking especially of a lot of the comparison sites where they'll say, you know, here's the top 10 hair dryers, and they'll rate and review those hair dryers.
Yeah.
That's where publishers have got the advantage, because surely you two don't trust Amazon's recommendations, surely, for hair dryers.
Yeah, well,
yeah,
hair dryer. Last time I bought one, you didn't have any recommendations on Amazon, or Amazon, actually.
But when it comes to
e-commerce.
When it comes to actually making a purchasing decision on something where you've maybe got a lot of options, that's where a lot of these places, you know, Tom's Guide, Expert Reviews, Which, and those sort of places, that's where you go to get an editor's opinion on
now,
which
ones are the best. Now, you see, you're approaching this as... I'm going to probably get a slap for this, but you're approaching this as a woman. We're approaching this as men.
Do you not research your purchases?
No, we just want the straightest route to the purchase. We don't want to dick around reviews and stuff, right, Chris?
Wow.
What? What the hell are you talking about? If it's stuff like... it depends on the sector. If it's like...
Chris, gaming headphones.
I will go to somewhere for reviews. Absolutely. If it's stuff like a jumper, I won't.
Amazon's going to win this one. You know, at the end of the day, all we're really doing is reinserting the middleman with these kind of recommendations.
People are bored. They're looking... You know, you'll come across an article of top 10 cute plant pots for your home. And that's not the sort of thing you necessarily directly go to Amazon to search for.
I agree with that.
It's this whole, like, surprise and delight thing, which magazine brands have always been really good at doing. So I'm bored, I'm scrolling through top 10 cute plant pots for my home, and that's when I find the plant pot I want to buy, rather than I want to buy a plant pot, let's go to Amazon. It's about kind of creating that intent.
I think that idea of inspiration is definitely something that magazines have always, you know, particularly magazines like Good Housekeeping or on the health side, Men's Health and Women's Health. That sort of inspiration to buy is definitely a plus. I mean, we've also talked a lot about subs revenue, you know, whether that's the New York Times or Condé or whoever. But there was an interesting piece in the Press Gazette this week from Politico editor Matt Kaminsky, editor-in-chief. And he says what's different about, I think, what they're doing is that they're going for these long-term premium subscription contracts, which obviously from their point of view is great because the money's in for longer and they don't have to think about the ad situation as much.
Yeah, I can remember Mark Alker talking about this when he was saying how much he hated depending on programmatic, because he just said it just goes up and down, whereas the subscriptions, you know what you're getting 12 months in advance.
So yeah. Subs are obviously there as well.
But I mean, that's a huge, huge kind of wear myself.
I was going to say, though, but to what extent then should you see... Because you remember when BuzzFeed turned on its programmatic spigot, they basically said, we're going to be treating this as free extra revenue, but we're not going to rely on it to the same extent. Obviously, that's since not been borne out. But to what extent then should you see ad revenue as a nice little bonus, but not one of those consistent?
Well, if you listen to the IAB guy, that's exactly what you should be doing.
Mix of six.
Mix of six. We should do a mix of six jingle.
Or t-shirts.
Bong, bong, bong. Mix of six.
It's been a while since we've had a patented
Peter
jingle.
Yeah, we haven't had a proper jingle for a while, haven't we? And now let's have the news in brief. So after all those chewy thoughts, we're going to get even chewier and look at some news in brief. The first story we've got here is just horrendous. It's from Neiman Lab. And it's rounding up a bunch of stuff that actually happened towards the end of the week. Most of it announced on Friday.
Yeah, though a lot of it, I mean, it started on Tuesday, really, with BuzzFeed News, and then it sort of rolled through, first with Quartz, and then Economist and Condé, and it was just a horrendous week, like you said, just snowballing terrible media news.
So I saw one roundup, and I think the Neiman Lab article says there's 350 media jobs gone. Condé Nast had 100 layoffs and furloughs, 100 plus 100 furloughs. Interesting comment about they were given a ratio of cost to revenue and then cut accordingly, which is, you know, there's no sentimentality going on there.
No, not at all.
BuzzFeed has got another 20 furloughs. Some of them may never come back. Quartz has 80 layoffs. Quartz has 80 layoffs. And interesting, Quartz is actually talking about closing offices in London and Hong Kong, San Francisco. There's a letter to staff from their chief exec. Is it Max Seward? Mm-hmm. That's the guy's name?
Yeah.
Yeah, Max Seward. And it's a really, really interesting read as to how he's trying to position the business for the future out of this. But still sad that there's all these people being laid off. Vice has 155 layoffs. Ben Smith talks about how the digital guys are getting laid off just the same as anyone else, which is interesting. It looks like the digital bubble's burst. Even The Economist, this is the one that kind of shook me. The Economist, although there's no editorial layoffs, they're paying off 90 people.
But, I mean, The Economist is, they have a huge events business. I think a lot of it is related to that.
And, Chris, what you've just said about BuzzFeed on Tuesday, that I actually forgot about that. There was that much other shit came out. But BuzzFeed's announcement that they were going to stop doing news in Australia and in the UK is just horrendous.
Yeah.
You know, that's really, really sad, but also bad.
Yeah, it's horrible. And, you know, there's been a couple of stories that have since come out since the closure, where you sort of go, well, BuzzFeed would have been all over that one.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that people have basically been saying news, BuzzFeed News UK never had a particularly strong revenue generation model, and it was always dependent on the US and its kind of, you know, counterpart in regular BuzzFeed. And people have said, well, you know what, in fact, you need to look at Facebook and Google for the culprit here, because they, yeah, and, you know, it's that, back to that old trope of casting the blame around. And it's just BuzzFeed, like, if it always felt like BuzzFeed News UK was an experiment to see if another part of the business could fund a news operation.
Yeah.
And it hit this iceberg and it just sank immediately.
It's such a shame, because, like, some of the work I can remember that, like, that some of the stuff they broke around Brexit, like the reporting in the UK was superb. Good. From that team.
Yeah. Some of the people who work for them are, you know, unparalleled in terms of journalistic quality. If you go back to, I think it's maybe our sixth or seventh episode ever, when we were still the Media Briefing podcast, can hear us talking about, should BuzzFeed News UK almost be spun off or sold off to somebody who can fund this? Because, and I think our argument at the time was, it's over-reliant on this, and its link to BuzzFeed so specifically is harming it as a, both reputationally and in terms of being able to stand on its own 2 feet.
But I mean, they have struggled to make themselves be taken seriously because of that association.
But you still get the comments about cat gifts, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, but they.
I was about to make one.
But the problem is that a lot of the staff. Rupert Murdoch has given up his entire bonus. Whoa. As News Corp has lost $1 billion in 3 months. The loss has been driven primarily by a slashed valuation of its Australian subscription TV business, Foxtel. But ad revenue declines are obviously not helping this one.
Facebook has agreed to pay $52 million to current and former moderators to compensate them for mental health issues developed on the job. So, I mean, well done to Casey Newton for really putting the pressure on them there.
Yeah, the piece he did on this, the kind of expose that he did on this originally was insane.
He's done multiple and like the follow up as well. Yeah.
So definitely the fact that I don't know how that gets divided between how many people or whatever, but the fact that it's been recognised is definitely good.
Apple has been asking the publishers participating in Apple News Plus for permission to produce audio versions of the stories there.
How's that going now?
This is problematic.
This is weird.
So many levels.
It's just weird.
I think some of the Apple execs have basically been reading stories from Neiman Lab and the like about the success some publishers have seen with audio versions of stories. And they've gone, I know, let's do the same thing, which if you're looking to add value to a product like this is not a bad thing. But the minefield with producing, with Apple producing audio versions of different publishers' stories is just...
So they would have, the publisher would have no involvement, Apple would just do it.
No involvement, rights are still to be discussed.
Oh, Apple.
And there's huge complicated compensation questions around if a writer has written something, if a freelancer has written something for a publication, how do they then get compensated for this? It's hugely complicated.
These people are bonkers.
And also, if say you're the journalist who's written this article and they go, hey, listen to this, and they've got, say, Joe Pasquale to read it out.
I was just thinking that. Listen to this, it's too good to miss.
Aren't you going to be like, well, you've just destroyed the credibility of my article?
That was brilliant.
I mean, Apple was pretty. So this week I spoke to John Byrne Murdoch, who is the FT's senior data visualization journalist. So most of our conversation focused on his work with their coronavirus trajectory trackers, but I started by asking him what he was working on at the FT before their coronavirus coverage exploded in popularity.
As a data journalist, the specialism is essentially the data, like the stuff we work with, rather than any particular subject matter. So it's really been quite varied. I mean, within that, it tends to follow like things I'm more interested in or have more knowledge of. So I do a lot of work on politics, quite a lot on economics, bits of sports, bits of environment. So a big range. I mean, if we looked over the last few months, I'm always heavily involved in our coverage of elections. So we did a lot of work in the lead up to and on the night and the aftermath of the UK election back in December. I was involved in a lot of our stuff on the US Democratic primaries, but also been working a lot with our economics team on things like regional inequality. That's something I've always done bits and pieces on. But you know, to give you an idea of the sort of output of our team, I'd say across our team of data journalists and visual journalists, we'll probably cover at least 100 more stories by the end of this year, easily. So So, you know, obviously COVID is a massive story, and that's one that all sorts of us, like all of us are involved in, and we're doing loads of stuff just on this one story. But even over the last few weeks, our team has been doing stuff on, you know, US job losses and the US election and just bits of like companies news and markets news. So we cover all sorts of things, but it's, for me, it's tended to be mainly politics and economics before this.
So, I mean, the coronavirus crisis, the work you've done there has been, at the forefront of what publishers have been doing with the data visualizations. If we rewind sort of to January and when this was all kicking off, what did those conversations look like around how you were going to approach it? Because it's not easy data.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because back then, and this is a nice thing with this one, you can look back and remember when this was just a remote little sort of world affairs story that we were interested in. And I remember the conversations because it's the kind of thing that our team is always involved in from an early phase, because the great thing with data is that it makes little difference whether we're doing a story about London or about Wuhan. You know, if the information is there, we've got something to do with it. So we were having conversations with our world news desk, like you say, in sort of January and certainly a lot in February, about what does this look like for the FT? You know, is this a China story or is it a global story? And do we do a couple of news stories or do we have an ongoing page tracking this? And we decided fairly early on that we needed an ongoing home for all things coronavirus, because, you know, once it became clear that this was spreading beyond Wuhan, you know, even when it was still confined to Asia, but outside of China, it was clear that this was going to be something that we'd want to follow, and to do so on a single plate, a single home, instead of lots of stories. So yeah, we started looking at that from very early on. And I guess the thing that was different back then was that when there were fewer countries involved and the numbers were all much lower, the data accuracy and precision felt like less of a concern, because it was individual, you know, the numbers changing from day to day were relatively small, and the Johns Hopkins team in America obviously had a pretty good handle on things. And of course, the thing that we now, like anyone who's been following this story now knows well, is that the data today is anything but crystal clear and anything but 100% reliable. So yeah, it's changed a hell of a lot. But back on day one, it was just a case of thinking, okay, like Johns Hopkins have a source here, they've got a spreadsheet, we'll just plug that in and do our stuff on the other end. Whereas since then, it's been a much more fiddly and manual reporting process.
Well, what does that process look like? You know, what does the workflow look like from day to day?
So it's changed loads as well, like over the weeks. So when I think back into the olden days of like early March, when I started making the trajectory charts, it was at that point still a case of, all right, pull in the data from Johns Hopkins, maybe update it with some fresh numbers from Spain or Italy or the UK that would come out in the evening. Because I guess one of the difficulties here in a newsroom is that the sources like Johns Hopkins and the European Centre for Disease Control and these other aggregators, they are good at getting the data out on a sort of 24-hour timeliness kind of way of doing things. But as a newsroom, if we've just published a story saying record number of deaths in Italy, then the data in our charts needs to reflect that update 5 minutes ago. So what became apparent fairly soon was that it was great that there are sources like ECDC and Johns Hopkins that we could pull in as a starting point, but we would then have to do a lot of manual data collection on the day to make sure that we had those European afternoon and evening updates in our data, even if they hadn't yet filtered through to the other aggregators. So I guess at the point over the weeks in early April, it probably would have been late March, early April, when this was as big an exercise as it got really for us. The way we were doing it was for a subset of about 10 countries of particular, let's say, editorial significance. So either these were the countries that the FT has most of its readers in, so like the UK and US, or they were countries that were significant to the story, so like Italy, France and Spain and China. For that selection of countries, we would go every day to the government websites in those countries and to press conferences and PDFs and all of this stuff, and we would pull out those numbers individually. It would often even be one of our correspondents in those regions chatting. I would chat to them directly and they would say, okay, I'm at the press conference and the officials just said it was 723 deaths today and 2,300 cases or something, and we would take those numbers directly from the horse's mouth, as it were. And so for the rest of the world, we'd be using data from ECDC or Johns Hopkins that might be a few hours out of date, but we knew that that had come from a trusted aggregator. And it was then this set of 10 or so countries that we were pulling in ourselves. And as I say, partly that was about timeliness. It was about making sure that all of the numbers we had were the very, very latest. But it's also because I think what often doesn't come across here is that the data from the likes of Johns Hopkins and the ECDC is also just being aggregated by teams just like ours. And that means just as we might make mistakes in our data, there are often little funny things going on in those data sets as well. So just this morning, for example, the data from one of the aggregators said that Italy had 2,195 deaths yesterday, when it was actually just 195, but someone had put an extra two in there. So I guess, yeah, in terms of the daily task, a lot of the time just went on this sort of sense checking. So every night, every evening as it was, I would be pulling in the data from the aggregators and from the government's websites. But then the crucial task, and often the thing that took the most time, was then starting to go through that and checking if it all made sense, because there would often be these things like a number typed in the wrong cell, or missing values for a country. And then there were the errors that, or not so much errors, but the inconsistencies that countries themselves introduced. So several times there have been countries that have decided to change their methodology halfway through. First it was China who changed its definition of a positive test. Then it was France who started including care home deaths alongside other deaths when other countries weren't doing that. Of course, the UK has done the same thing recently. And then from time to time, you'll get a country which releases a backlog of positive tests or deaths all in one dump, even though those that number represents deaths or tests that have occurred over a period of weeks. So a lot of the time on any given day or evening of updating these charts went into that second phase after we'd pulled in the data, just saying, does this all make sense? Does any of this look weird? If it looks weird, is it a mistake, or is it because a country has changed what it's doing today? If a country has changed what it's doing, how do we address that? So in some cases, we would strip out non-hospital deaths, for example, so we were comparing all countries like for like. In others, we would take one of these backlog dumps of data and we would ourselves spread it out across multiple days to remove the idea that a country had had suddenly a huge number of positive tests or deaths in one day. So that sense checking, sanity checking and cleaning essentially has always been the biggest task here. And I think that's the biggest difference between COVID data and COVID as a data story and anything else that journalists usually work with. Because usually when you're working with GDP or unemployment data or climate change, temperature data, anything like that, we're used, and this isn't just data journalists, but any journalist, you're used to seeing a number and you just know that number is what it is, and yeah, that you can compare the number from the UK with the number from India with the number from the US. But the thing that's become very apparent early on here is that that's absolutely not the case. And so most of our work as data journalists is getting to the point when we can compare these numbers to one another. And that includes a lot of adjustments and checking against alternative data sources all the way through.
I know people say numbers don't lie, but in this case, numbers can be very, very much manipulated to make political points. And I've seen governments doing this with charts that journalists have been producing. How do you kind of approach that, trying to level everything out and get all the data so that you can compare it in a way that, is it possible to do that without being political? Like, how do you manage that in your team?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. And I think any data journalist who says that data is objective and you know, it can't, and it's the highest form of, or the most, you know, the purest form of journalism, I think they're pulling your leg. So anyone who's worked with data knows exactly that depending on what data sources you use and depending on what version of some data you use, you know, do you do per capita adjustments or not? Do you use a linear scale or log scale? Do you use the mean or the median? All of these things affect the output. And as soon as you know, as the journalist, as soon as you know that changing these measures, even if they're all technically legitimate, as soon as you know that changing them will change the order in which countries appear, for example, that sort of becomes, you're making an editorial decision, because you know that, you know, I know that if I change to per capita, the US won't look as bad, but Switzerland and Belgium will look worse. And so, you know, the way you have to do it is you just have to put all of the politics of it aside and think, what is the fairest or just sort of straightest way of doing this stuff? And I think the nice thing for me in this process is that because I've been quite open and transparent in communicating the rationale for this stuff on Twitter, for example, or in interviews, I've had to hold myself to that, really. Like, you know, once I've set out why I think certain metrics are the best ones to use for statistical and graphical reasons, the nice thing there is I can say, well, look, those decisions were made. That was the reason for it. And that's what we're going to stick with. And if I'd suddenly switched from using absolute numbers to per capita, then people could rightly ask, oh, have you done that because it changes the story? So, yeah, you know, these are absolutely editorial decisions as well as technical ones. But as I say, all we've tried to do at the FT, and I think I'm sure this is the same for most people covering this story, is just to be fair and again, to try and do this for the right reasons, make these decisions for statistical reasons rather than political ones, because, you know, the feedback we've had to these charts is highly partisan. And the people, yeah. not just the feedback, but people sharing our charts. There are people I've seen using our charts to make points that I can't fathom how they decided that this chart makes that point. There've been versions of the charts going around with all sorts of annotations scribbled on them. And, you know, on the one hand, that's the great thing about data visualization, is that people can read into it all sorts of different things beyond the top level numbers. But as you said, it does mean that we've had to be acutely aware of the fact that this has become a very political topic, and any number that we put out isn't going to be reported just as a straight number. It's going to be reported as the number that proves X is bad and Y is good. The number of letters to the editor and bits of feedback and that kind of stuff we've had from these charts is absolutely huge. I've had more conversations with our like reader liaisons team, and even with the editor herself, I've had more conversations over the last few weeks than I ever had done before because of the feedback to these charts. So as you say, these have become, they may be quantitative and objective and in terms of the calculations, but they are highly personal to people.
And I know you've kept quite a lot of communication on Twitter about, like, you've invited people to ask you questions. Are there any kind of really common misconceptions or challenges that have come up that you've kind of had to deal with and respond to?
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of things here. I think, and the misconceptions and things sort of work in different ways. I think the misconception, one misconception is just the idea that this data is, does exactly what it says on the tin. I think, you know, the fact that every Tuesday morning now the latest UK death numbers come out, and at that point we suddenly have three or four different numbers, all of which on some level claim to be a count of UK COVID deaths. We have the number that the government's reported the previous evening, we have the number that the ONS has reported that morning, we have the number of excess deaths from the ONS that morning, and it just means Tuesdays are always this crazy time when you have people writing all of these stories, each of them based on an official number, proving that the UK is the worst or the second worst or the third worst, or things are at their peak or they're slightly off their peak. And so one of the things is just a misconception that the data here is nearly as sort of unequivocal as anything else. But I think, you know, there are all sorts of things. There's been the whole debate about whether these numbers should be adjusted for a country's population. That's one that I was more involved in that debate earlier, and then I've sort of gladly taken a bit of a step back more recently. There aren't many concerns, misconceptions that have come our way that I've felt have been unjustified. I think every time someone has said, hang on a minute, shouldn't you be doing X? I think their concern has almost always come from the right place. But it's just that, as we've said, this data and this phenomenon, and these are not the normal things that we talk about. And while there are plenty of phenomena where adjusting for a population size, for example, is absolutely the first thing you should do, there are other things when it doesn't necessarily give you any benefits, and it can even make things a bit more skewed. So there's been constant debate around this stuff. We get the same thing on excess mortality at the moment. So every day when we put those numbers out, we'll get some people coming in and saying, hang on, these numbers are exaggerating things, because not all of these excess deaths are going to be people dying from COVID. They're going to be all sorts of things caused by the lockdown or caused by people staying away from hospitals. But I'll also get a lot of people saying, hang on, these numbers are an underestimate because they're not accounting for the fact that there have been fewer deaths from road accidents or homicides. And both of those concerns are true, but that to me is exactly why excess deaths are a good measure, because they're affected in both directions, and so at the end of the day they're probably going to be fairly close to accurate. So again, I don't feel that people are sort of trolling on any of this stuff. I mean, there have been one or two that I've had to take a deep breath and ignore, but generally I think it's just that this is a really tricky issue. There aren't many straightforward one word answers or one number answers. And to be honest, I think it's been a great experience as a journalist to cover it for that reason, because it's a very conversational story. Like, we're in constant dialogue with readers, with epidemiologists, with academics, and this whole thing is a conversation. I think a lot of people are starting to become aware that even on the science side, a lot of answers on COVID are not straightforward. It's taken months for people, for experts, to work out whether everyone should wear masks or not. There's still a lot of debate about whether lockdown timing is the single critical factor. No one really knows what the R number is right now, for example. So I think it's just been a case of everyone learning that data and science and all of this stuff are fuzzier than we might have thought. And as a result, yeah, being at the centre of those conversations has been really, really rewarding.
I mean, in a way, a lot you're not going to get a lot of clarity on a lot of this for many months to come yet. I mean, you know, we're still getting death rates in from 3 weeks ago in the UK, let alone anywhere else.
No, exactly that. And you know, at the start of this year, our team at the FT was thinking, okay, this is a US election year, and that's going to dominate our work.
Simpler times.
Indeed, yeah. And obviously, it still is a US election year, and we've got people working on that who've been working on that since January and have remained on that even while this has been going on. But yeah, we at the same time, we know that coronavirus isn't going anywhere anytime soon, and the story is changing, but it's not disappearing. You know, the focus is now shifting onto countries easing lockdown, and then it may go on to second waves. There's a growing consensus that normality isn't going to resume really, and therefore that remains a story, the fact that things aren't back to normal, and so we'll still be covering that. So we're going to have people, I suspect myself and various others, still working on this for the FT for months, if not even longer. And yeah, it's just a question of juggling things, because we don't want to neglect other bits of the FT's coverage that we would otherwise be doing. But yeah, it's a huge sprawling story. I mean, I remember it was the week before at the FT, the week before we started working from home. So I think maybe the first week of March, it just became very clear during that week that our team's workload had suddenly shot through the roof. There were several evenings that week when a lot of us were still in the office well beyond 7 p.m. And that was because there were data stories springing up across all parts of the FT. The markets team wanted to look at whether the markets were dipping faster than they ever had done before. And then obviously the health team were looking at things on that. And yeah, it's been a huge story. It's going to continue to be a huge story. And I think I'm sure I'll still be working on COVID-related stuff well into the tail end of the year.
And the FT chose to put this coronavirus, the data, all the charts in front of their paywall, so it's free for everybody to access. Has the FT seen, and I don't want to use the word benefits, because obviously it's a horrendous health story, but has the FT kind of seen benefits in terms of audience and readership growth from this?
The thing on that is that the FT's analytics and audience teams are fantastic, and the way we tend to do things is we never ascribe a subscription to one story. We don't say, oh, what was the last thing someone read before subscribing? It's a much more long-term view of the various triggers that might have led someone to subscribe. So it's hard to know. It's pretty much impossible to know, I think, whether we've got subscribers based purely on these pieces. But anecdotally, I can absolutely point to specific examples where people have emailed or tweeted to say, I've subscribed to the FT because of this piece of work. Or we've had people who'd let their subscription lapse and have resubscribed. So,
I mean, I would guess it's a huge traffic hitter.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the main page that the trajectory charts all used to sit in is now, by a large margin, the FT's most viewed page ever. But incidentally, the second most viewed ever was our Brexit poll tracker page that we did back in June 2016. So the data team has a good record with this stuff. But yeah, you know, we are absolutely seeing people subscribe to the FT as a direct result of these pieces of work, as well as all the rest of our coverage recently. And there'll also obviously be an effect, a bit like there was in summer 2016, and then after Trump came in as well, in terms of people just reacting to a major shock event like this by thinking, I need to support quality journalism. So I think it'll partly be that larger scale quality journalism effect, and partly, yeah, it's been great to see people responding directly to this page. But yeah, you know, it's definitely brought people to the FT, and I think it's been great that people, especially, you know, there are people who maybe haven't had much of a relationship with the FT before March and April of this year, and would have thought, oh, they just cover finance.
Yeah.
And yeah, exactly. And I think, of course, COVID is absolutely, it's a huge finance and business and an economic story. But for people to see the Financial Times covers diseases and covers people and covers health, I think it's great that we've been able to show that as well. So yeah, you know, it was ultimately a decision about wanting to put public service journalism in front of the public, but it has all sorts of sort of side benefits for us and for the readers.
You touched on it briefly there, but I've seen data journalists around, I mean, not just the coronavirus crisis, but Brexit and things like that. They've been described as, you know, the new rock stars in journalism. Have you seen a shift in the importance of the role over the years you've been in the field?
I mean, my sort of initial hackles raised answer to that is like, well, you know, data journalism has always been
great.
We've always been doing great stuff. But no, I mean, I think for me, it's that I think there's two things I'd say on this. One is that the way I've come to think about COVID for data journalists is that it's a bit like covering an election, but where there's an election every day for months, in the sense that this is when we cover elections, they are sort of for a few days, we as data journalists are the centre of the operation and the centre of where readers' eyes are going, you know, because we're looking at the results, we're looking at the polls, we're looking at who voted for whom and why, and we become the epicentre of all of the coverage for say the few days before and after and on the night, and that's essentially been the dynamic this time, but it's just not stopped. So this is a story where you can't really consume this story without data. I mean, of course, you absolutely can, and maybe it would be a bit less frantic if you did. But people need numbers when they're being told by their government that their country is doing well or that testing is increasing. And so the need for numbers obviously points editors and readers to us. But more generally, yeah, I mean, I think you're right in the sense that there is more and more information out there which is already quantified, or it's at least quantifiable. It's something that we as data journalists can gather and quantify. And that means there are more and more topics and events where you know, pulling together the information and visualising it and putting it out there is going to be the best way to cover it, especially, you know, in the advent of techniques like web scraping, where we can now create structured data sets from written information online as well. What I'd also say is this isn't just about data journalists. I think it's also about the need for all journalists to be a bit more data literate, because it doesn't, you'd struggle to cover something like COVID authoritatively if you're not data literate, because yeah, all you could then go on is what your sources or the government spokespeople are saying to you, and then of course if they are wrong or if they're deliberately trying to mislead, then you're just laundering that sort of false or misleading information. So yeah, I think the way the world is moving, the ability to obtain clean, analysed, visualised data is only going to grow more important, and yeah, for data journalists, yeah, it's a huge opportunity.
And the last question we ask all our guests is, what's the last thing you read, watched or listened to that really affected you?
Yeah, I had to have a think about this, because most of the things I've read, watched or listened to recently have been about coronavirus.
Oh, I know.
But yeah, one breather from that recently was I belatedly caught up and watched the film Roma, the Alfonso Cuarón film, a couple of weeks ago. And it was, you know, just watching something beautifully shot and a sort of quiet film just about life and about smaller challenges and problems in life than a global pandemic. It was just a really nice perspective change, and it demonstrated that, sure, we've got a sort of global crisis here, but there are all sorts of things going on all over the world which are causing people immense stress and huge challenges every day. And yeah, just essentially it sort of humanized the whole thing, I think.
So we've now done 2 full weeks worth of issues of our Media Roundup, our daily media newsletter, which goes out to your inbox every morning. You can sign up on our website, which is voices.media. It's the top 3 or 4 stories you need to know each day that's going to make a difference to you and the industry, And we've had now the odd guest editor for it.
As Chris said, you can go to our website, voices.media. You can find the latest episode. You can find our episode archive. You can find transcripts. You can find some writing that we've done. There's all sorts of stuff on there. But most importantly, sign up to the daily newsletter on the website, voices.media.
And you can follow us on Twitter. All the stories we put out each day go on there. So we're there at Media Voices Pod.
So come back next week. Stay safe. And thanks for listening.
Bye.
I don't think we're staying safe anymore. I think we're staying alert.
Oh, f*** sake.
That's a great place to end it.